And tonight we talk about Planet X. By the way, look at our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com at the animation of the pink planet. That's right. Astronomers have snapped a photo of a pink alien world. That's the smallest yet exoplanet found around a star like our sun. The alien planet's called GJ504b is a colder world than astronomers had anticipated, and it is likely has a dark magenta hue to it. The exoplanet orbits the bright star GJ504, 57 light years from Earth, slightly hotter than the sun, and faintly visible to the naked eye in the constellation Virgo. The star system is relatively young. It's only 160 million years old. Comparison, Earth is 4.5 billion. Can you imagine that? Well, up next, Marshall Masters joins us as we talk about Planet X on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome, Marshall Masters with us, author, publisher, internet radio host, founder of Your Own World Books. He's a former CNN Science Features news producer, by the way. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Marshall, always a pleasure. How are you?
Great to be back, George. Thank you.
Likewise. Lots of things going on in space. Now they find pink planets.
Yeah, they're finding pink planets. They're looking for the... That's the big holy grail of astronomy now, is the extrasolar planets. It's kind of like, let's look for some place to live before we lose the viewing sky, you know?
You got that right. What have you been working on, Marshall?
What we've been working on, we've been following up since last time I was on, was on the object of interest at Turrialba and the Volcan feed.
Yeah.
And the Volcan feed was closed for a while because of volcanic eruptions, and the new camera in place is not as good. It's also was donated by the United States government. It has a big USA aid on there. But we do have some of our stringers that are finding where it's still Bluebonnet is popping up on this new third camera as well. But in the meantime, I had a gentleman by the name of Jorge Arena. He's a businessman. He's international. He's based in Ontario, and he flies on a regular basis down to the Amazon, where he imports food products. And he was going down back in May. It was a day. It just was odd coincidence. It was a beautiful day for a triple conjunction of Mercury, Venus, and Jupiter, which was well documented. And he caught an image of that. At 4 degrees south of the equator, and also at 4 degrees above. And the nice thing is, he had a good little camera, and he took. And I told him what he needed to do, and he did that setup and was testing it. And we thought for a bit he just had some interesting pictures of this triple conjunction that was pretty unique. But as we got into it, we found he actually had imaged the brown dwarf in the core of the Planet X system, which is right now behind the sun. He caught it close to the sun around the 7 o'clock position. And it was just something where, you know, our motto on the team is believe nothing, observe everything, and leave no stone unturned. And we were, you know, George, it was just something where, you know, we were just thinking, well, it was a great effort on his part. And it's so hard because I always have people talking about, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And then they just evaporate on you. And this guy's a soldier. I mean, he's really out there. He's on fire to go find this thing. And we found it in this image where it was 4 degrees north of the equator. And we find the triple conjunction. But we also find that there's a fourth object in this picture, which is in my new video, Planet X Observations and Orbital Path Analysis, on my site at YOWUSA.com. And all of this is demonstrated, but he nailed it. He caught it. And one of the things that we do is, first off, it's visible to the eye. And this is a visible light observation, which is really unique. The approximate distance right now is about 2 Jupiter distances out.
Okay.
So it's all still right. A pretty good, but it's inbound. It's right now, having captured it in May, at this point, it's near, probably coming up nearer to the ecliptic, but it's also, we can't see it. The sun is blocking it right now, and it's going to stay that way for a little while. We are able to do an orbital path analysis to see where this thing's going. And what we used is we have our object at Turrialba. This object that we've been monitoring, Blue Bonnet, is an outermost orbital of this system. And this is now three cameras that we're seeing it on, and they're three different, completely different camera systems. The first one back in 2010 was a standard definition, and then in late 2012, they got a high-definition system, and then we started observing in this year, and now on the third one. And so there was this young gentleman who, back in 2010, was, for some reason, just inspired to go capture the Vulcan feed and put up videos of that feed capture. And so we had this object back in 2010, which was showing up not as long. I mean, it is, when we were watching it on the Vulcan feed, the duration was much longer. It was a few hours. But we were able to get a plot on it, approximate its location in the sky in 2010, and then we had our observation from 2013, and we used that plus Jorge Arena's image of the brown system dwarf, and we were able to approximate an orbital path analysis. And so, if you want, I can just give you kind of a look-ahead timeline of...
Okay, and then give us a refresher on Planet X, Marshall.
Will do. Planet X is... We've been looking for Planet X for hundreds of years. This is not anything new, and the term is a generic term. And it just simply means an unknown object or body. And you know it's out there because of the way it interacts with bodies that we are already observing. So, for example, we can see as far as Saturn with the naked eye. Once we invented the telescope and Saturn was observed and there was perturbations in Saturn's orbit and they started looking for its planet X, and then, you know, that took us all the way out to Pluto through the whole process where, you know, Uranus and Neptune and then Pluto. And Pluto, of course, turned out not to be planet X because it's only about 60% of the size of our moon, so it didn't have the mass to be Neptune's perturber, which means that the game is still afoot. And there's an awful lot of, for years, even, you know, you go back in my interviews, gosh, you know, it's been a decade of being on coast and talking about Planet X, and I can remember back when I was just telling, you know, we don't know what it is. It could be a comet. It could be a rogue planet. It could be gosh knows what. But we know it's out there. Now we know that it is a mini constellation. It has a sun at the center of it, and we have spotted one of its outermost orbitals. And right now the core of that system with the brown dwarf is... like I said, it's if you're looking at the sun, and the thing of it is that people have to understand that you have to adjust your view for not the Earth's horizon, but the ecliptic, the plane of the solar system.
It must, Marshall, though, let me ask you, it must be doing something or will do something devastating, or they would have told us about it, right?
Well, it's already doing devastating things. I mean, I'm looking at sun activity and, you know, I mean, gosh, hey, George, how much, think back to before 2012, how much time were we all talking about the big solar maximum of 2012, 2013 that NASA and everybody else was predicting? And instead of this big slam you in the head solar maximum with all this high activity, what we wound up into was, you know, this camel's hump back, you know, kind of like a two-hump camel. So we have a twin peak solar maximum where the first peak was pretty weak. Now we're in this trough, and we're seeing these coronal cavities that are just stunning. I mean, we recently had a coronal cavity. It was like 25% of the size of the sun itself. And now we're seeing these coronal cavities. Stereo B right now, which is actually it's on the other side of the sun from us, and Stereo B is pointed at the sun, and it's looking, if you will, over our right shoulder. Stereo A, which is the other stereo spacecraft, that's for ahead, and it's looking over our left shoulder. And but NASA has said they're not actually looking in the direction that we've been looking, which is straight into the sun and looking in the areas around it for objects. They don't have anything pointed in that direction. That's their story. What we did was we developed a technique called camera sensor illumination. This is something that I teach in this video, because I want people to have a research tool that they can use on their own with freely available software and information on the internet, so that, you know, I said, okay, if we lose all these webcams, we lose all this stuff, what do we got? Well, we got cell phones, we got high definition smartphones, and we've got prosumer digital cameras. And what I did was the whole point of camera sensor illumination is not so much the object itself, but it's what's around the object is what you're looking for. And literally what you're doing with this technique is you're letting this object, if it's a hot object and it's shooting photons of light at you, all right, a reflection, sun dog, lens aberrations, defects, all this kind of stuff, they don't generate photons. All right, and what they do is manipulate what's there, and so we call those cold objects. But a hot object is literally going to backlight the water vapor in our atmosphere. And so I take the viewers through this step by step by step by step, so that, one, they can, you know, when we present the images in the video, I want people to be able to do it shoulder to shoulder. I think, you know, one of the things that's good about that is, you know, it's just always been for take my word for it. You know, who do we trust? Is this guy reliable? Is this picture from an honest source? Did they Photoshop it? You have all those what if questions. Well, with camera sensor illumination, you can look at objects near to the sun and you can determine whether they're natural or just reflections. And it's a really, really simple thing to do. And that is how we found this in the actual test when we got this original image of these four objects from Jorge. And he took a lot of pictures from that trip.
Are a lot of people seeing this, Marshall?
No, George, this is not. This particular picture was right place at the right time. His location when he took it was at 37,000 feet, way out over the Pacific to the west of northwest of Lima, Peru. So he was in an absolute beautiful spot for viewing skies. One of the things that's really important, and people don't realize it, but the chemtrail spraying really does make it difficult, much more difficult for those of us, particularly when we're below the clouds, to see something. And so he was at the right place at the right, exact right time. He imaged it, and it was the first visible light, non-governmental observation of the brown dwarf sun at the core of the mini system, which is way, you know, it's a good distance out there and on the other side of the sun. And we're kind of in a dance, Earth and this object. We rotate about, you know, nearly the same speed from what we're seeing from following Bluebonnet, which means that, you know, the ancients and gosh, I mean, we've heard this, we found this in so much research and so have many others, that when this thing does pop up, it's like a thief in the night. Boom. you know, it just shows up. And it's because it'll come out from beneath, from behind the sun and reach its point of perihelion. And that's when things really get rough. But right now, these coronal cavities are just stunning me, particularly the ones that Stereo B was shot. That it's on the opposite side of the sun from us now. We're not going to see it until it comes around. And for your listeners, a coronal cavity on the sun, a good way to imagine what this looks like is think of an orange, but the meat of the orange, instead of being orange, is jet black, black as coal. And what you do is you bite off a little chunk of skin here and you bite off a little chunk of skin there, and then you hold it out and you see something that is, you know, essentially what you see with a coronal cavity. And these are very prominent features. They're rather stunning. And we're looking at this. We're looking at the abnormal solar behavior. We're into a double peak solar maximum that completely blindsided NASA and everybody else. So I see that happening. I'm looking at what's happening with our planet right now, with our weather weirding. We have this jet stream displacement that's giving us, you know, I mean, this is, for some people, this summer has been the coldest on record.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, can we expect some kind of huge calamity because of this?
Yeah. Yeah. The timeline right now is, I would say, late 2013 to early 2014. The brown dwarf is going to be in a superior conjunction. That's on the opposite side of the sun inside Earth's orbit. These are rough estimates based on what we're looking at. There's no way with this number of bodies in space to formulate a dead spot on accurate ephemeris, where you can say it's definitely going to be here at a certain time, other than we have observed it, we've compiled it, and we've got a good idea of where it is and how long it's going to get there. But we can't set hard dates. These are just approximate dates. But end of this year, into the beginning of next year, I believe we're going to start seeing more severe interactions with our sun. And I'm talking about solar storms. Right now, I mean, there's been some X-class flares and things like that.
We've been lucky.
Yes, haven't we? And we have not been in the crosshairs. I don't think we're going to be so lucky later on. I think because there's going to be more of them, and we're more likely to get caught in the crosshairs. That is also going to, that's going to set in motion a big increase in volcanism and seismicity. And, you know, the thing that really, it's just kind of stunning is you look at the mainstream media, you know, you're talking on the cable channels, cable news and Fox and whatever. And we're so preoccupied with show trials and political packages and, you know, athletes taking drugs, and they keep pumping it and the same stories again and again and again. But when you start looking at what's happening around the world, and you're going to the internet and you're going to these other sources, wow, we have a lot of unusual. We have a lot of volcanoes that are waking up.
No, you're right. They're all popping. Marshall, we're going to take this quick break, but we're going to come right back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Marshall Masters, our special guest as we talk about Planet X. And, of course, next hour we'll take your phone calls with Marshall Masters as we talk about Planet X. Hey, by the way, congratulations to Bruce Bateman in Houston, whose brother had a little baby. Congratulations, Bateman. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Marshall, the Planet X that you are seeing with some of your colleagues, is it the same Planet X that Zechariah Sitchin has been writing about? God rest his soul.
Yes.
Is this the one that has the Anunnaki on it?
I don't know if it has. I mean, we've only observed objects from the sky. I don't know if it's got life on the planet. We're told it does, but in terms of the object that we're looking for that Zachariah Sitchin wrote about, we've found the object, yeah.
Is this the one that has that 3,600-year elliptical orbit?
Yes.
Okay, so we're honing in on this thing.
Yeah, I mean, and it was, gosh, it was just a fortunate bit of luck that we found it in this. I mean, first off, we shouldn't even, you know, if when we're comparing this to like comets and other objects that we know about, you're just not expecting to see a visible light observation of it. But we have this visible light observation, and it, you know, it's just something where you have to be at the right place at the right time to catch it. This gentleman was there, and the nice thing about it, camera captured his GPS coordinates, which is really good. We were able to plot that against Starry Night. And the only thing that was noticeable that on Starry Night was showing in that area or stellarium would be Aldebaran out 68 light years away. And this thing is really bright. What we do in this new camera sensor illumination technique that I developed, and people can learn how to do it watching our video, is that when we did a what we call a step-down gamma. You know, what I did, George, was I just reverse-engineered all of this stuff. And I'm looking at it, and everyone's pulling out their hair, and they're trying to take pictures and figure out this stuff from the sun. And I went, you know, the problem we're having is we're not seeing it the same way. You know, what's the first thing you take any class on negotiation, the first thing they tell you is you got to get on the other side of the table and think like them. And then you can talk to them what's about important to them. And so I said, all right, let's stop looking at this the way we always look at things, which is ancient. It goes back to the very first days of film cameras where you see something and you imagine a picture hanging on the wall, and then you use the camera to take that picture that way. And it's all done on one sheet of film. With digital cameras today, it's a completely different technology, different way of capturing the images, and it's a building block approach. Things are broken down into camera sensors. There's these large arrays of sensors that are going to be in your camera. And what we found was when I analyzed the technology, the photo imaging technology, was that I could see that we were able to track patterns of what we call foreground illumination. So you have a hot object, and what it does is it is going to light up, or if you will, backlight the atmosphere that you have. And we, you know, water, we think of water being transparent. It's translucent.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why we have windshield wipers on our cars. And so if you want transparent water, you got to make it in a laboratory. And I actually got the idea from a National Geographic article that was written in 2005. And it just said that, you know, there was a lot more vapor in the sky now than ever before, that plus chemtrails. But when I looked at that being more vapor, I just said, well, how do I use that to our advantage? And so you see a halo around it, a natural hot object, all right? And in the video, I actually use a sequence I found on YouTube of some divers, a whole class of scuba divers at night with flashlights in the water. And, you know, the flashlights are pointed at the camera and then they're pointed away. And it was a great thing for me to illustrate the differences and what you're looking for in terms of edge definition, color halos, and the foreground illumination where you can see in a specific sensor, you can see the water vapor being lit up. If it's a reflection, a cell phone, sun dog, all of that stuff, you don't see it. They're cold objects. They don't have well-defined edges. They don't have halos. They don't illuminate the water in the atmosphere. So, and this is something that's very easy for people to do. They can learn this and do it themselves. That was my big thing in doing this video.
Well, what would be your concern, Marshall, primarily about Planet X? I mean, what concerns you about this?
Wow. What really concerns me is what's going to start happening, I'd say, from 2015 on. This is in 2015. First off, the outermost orbital, which right now we're tracking from a volcano at like 10,000 feet. That's the whole problem, is that this stuff hasn't come close enough. It's visible below the clouds for the rest of us mundane mortals, if you will. And so, but in 2015, that object is going to become that outermost orbital, or the blue bonnet that we've been tracking. That's going to become visible below the clouds. We're going to be seeing that. But this is when this thing's going to be creeping up from behind the sun, and we're kind of converging in our orbits towards each other. We're moving. We did determine, looking at our orbital analysis, particularly on Bluebonnet, that we are closing with this system. We're closing very slowly. And what'll happen is this thing's going to come around. It's not going to come over the top of the sun, but it's going to come around more like around to the 3 o'clock position. It's at that, when it reaches its point of perihelion, and it's going to be sometime in this time that it does become visible to the naked eye for the rest of us here on the planet. But at that time, it's, you know, when it enters the point of perihelion, this is its, in its 3,600-year orbit that takes it all the way from the edge of our system and into the core of our system and back again. The point of perihelion is its closest distance to the sun. So this whole mini constellation, which is a small brown dwarf, probably about twice the size of Jupiter.
And it's all traveling in unison, right?
It's all traveling in unison, and that system is in orbit around our sun. So it's not going to behave or look like anything else that we've ever seen before, which is consistent with what the ancients tell us. But when it reaches that point of perihelion, where it's closest to the sun in its 3,600-year orbit, it enters what we call the kill zone. And the kill zone is goes from perihelion to the ecliptic. Perihelion, its closest point. Ecliptic is the plane of the system. And this is where we would anticipate the greatest number of interactions between the sun and this system, resulting in what I would just say, you know, biblical scale solar storms.
Wow, that's huge.
Really going, yes, you know, at that time, it is really going to slam us and slam us hard. And it's not going to do it directly. The sun is going to do the worst of the damage to us, and so we're going to have to deal with solar storms. We're going to have to learn to go to ground during the day, so to speak.
Well, and here we are without an insulated grid, Marshall, and we've been warning people for years.
Yes, you're absolutely right, George. And, you know, we're buck naked. But on the other hand, look back to in 2007, 2008, when we saw was just breathtaking for us, because NASA, JAXA, ESA, all of these space agencies have been putting up a veritable armada of solar observatories. You know, for the longest time, it was just SOHO, which came into being as a result of a solar storm that took down a huge chunk of the grid in Canada. And SOHO is an old bird. It should have been, you know, it should have been deactivated some time ago, but it's like a Timex.
Keeps on ticking.
Keeps on ticking.
Let me ask you about the Hopis very fast, Marshall.
Yeah.
The Hopis talked about the blue Kachinka. And, you know, you've somewhat talked about this planet with this hue. Are we talking about one and the same there, too?
Yes, this is consistent with the Hopi prophecy, which is the blue Kachina and the red Kachina. And what the Hopi tell us is that we see the blue Kachina first, and but then followed behind that is the red Kachina, and what the Hopi prophecy says, when we see the blue Kachina, we're going to have a certain degree of natural issues going on, but it's not until the red Kachina shows up that the guacamole hits the fan. So the blue Kachina is actually this object we have been monitoring since the beginning of this year from the Volcan feed at the Turrialba volcano. It just was one of those things that we lucked into it. The feed is, most of your volcano feeds, George, point to the east because people want to catch those spectacular sunrises, or they're going to be pointed down into the bowels of the volcano itself.
Are you more concerned about the volcanoes, Marshall?
I'm concerned about the volcanoes. I'm concerned very much. When we talk about global cataclysm, you know, it's like we've never really yet seen one single event that impacts the whole planet, all right? Not us in modern days. I mean, if we'd have been around in the time when Krakatoa popped, you know, that would have been a different thing. But I think what we're going to see first, before anything else, is we're going to start seeing methane releases. And because that's already trending, George, it's already happening. And there's two particular areas of methane that we need to be really worried about. There's the Arctic methane, which is up in the permafrost. The permafrost is melting. But also you have this humongous supply of gas hydrate that is locked up and is sitting off our continental shores. And the highest density of this methane gas hydrate is around the island of Japan. That's spooky. And the thing about it is that when this methane hydrate, if you know, we warm up the oceans, this methane literally is called burning ice. They pick it up, they bring it up from the seabed, and they can just light it, and it'll burn. But if the water gets warm enough, the methane will just start releasing. And then the problem is that we start getting into a positive feedback loop, because as a global warming gas, if you, for example, 1 pound of carbon is about, I think, 21 pounds of methane. Or excuse me, 1 pound of methane is the equivalent of 21 pounds of carbon. So it is a much worse gas for global warming, and we're already seeing natural release patterns are on the uptick all the way around the globe. Now, interestingly enough, methane from man-made sources is trending downwards a little bit. And so this is it blows a hole in this whole anthropomorphic, it's all our fault kind of thing, because we're actually, you know, ratcheting down on the methane a little bit. But natural sources and the releases are steadily upticking, and my concern is that we would hit, we hit a point where it's a feedback loop, starts feeding on itself, and then we're going to just see incredibly awful weather. So all of the things that we're seeing now, George, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
Oh, boy.
And then we're going to, in a couple of years, what I'm saying in the video is, and I'm really loathe to do dates anymore, but at a bare bones minimum, dumb luck, you know, the universe smiles on us from soup to nuts. Yeah, we're talking a 3-year thing, but could very well be a decade. So we're looking at a slow motion train wreck, and it just gets worse as it goes along, because as it's going through the kill zone, then the next thing is it's going to be passing back from the northern skies back into the southern skies.
Well, at what point, Marshall, does, let's say, NASA or someone have to come out and say something? At what point do even amateur astronomers start seeing this?
Well, I think that NASA, the government is going to tell us at the last possible moment. In terms of what NASA can see, as far as we're concerned, they've been watching this thing for decades. All right? There's a difference between what can NASA see and what does NASA tell us it can see. All right?
That's true.
And I think that, you know, what you have is a situation where you would have astronomers and scientists there that would want to be forthcoming and talk and tell people. But what will happen is that you'll have someone from the security side that goes, no,
Marsh,
we're going to put a lid on this.
A couple people in the past on this program talked about Planet X in 2003 rolling around. It never happened. So, you know, here we are 10 years later. You're talking about 2015. And as you just said, you don't like talking dates. How could they be off by 12 years?
That's a good question, George. You know, 2003 was, that was the Nancy Leader non-event.
Yes.
And Nancy is, I put a video up on it. She just started attacking a whole bunch of other researchers. And I don't know, she just kind of just went off the edge a little there. You know, woo. But back in 2003...
was something going on? Was there
was nothing going on. You know, in 2003, we had started our research at the end of 2001. Nancy Leader says it's going to show, we're going to have all these disasters. We're looking at all of our stuff, all of our indicators, and we're going, where's this coming from? I mean, and we were publishing, you know, Zeta Factors, Zeta Hysteria was like one of the articles that we published. And we were up there at the front saying, hold on a second, can we be rational here? We were asking serious questions. A lot of people were turning to us for help. And George, I was getting emails from people that broke my heart. It was just horrible. You could see them struggling to phrase their questions and concerns, you know, without looking like they're coming unglued. But the fear was just oozing out from every paragraph, you know, like cement coming out of the, you know, when you're stacking bricks.
Well, are we going to start that again by talking about 2015?
I think it's a different thing. 2003 was a tempest in a teapot. I think with 2015, I'm not interested in going down the Nancy Leader path. My position right now is December 21, 2012, all right, which was a media event principally driven by the cable channel. And I have no problems about all the ad revenue that everybody made on that, because the fact is December 21, 2012 was a line in the sand. That was a day that, you know, you had to be a hermit living in a cave in the Appalachians and still waiting for Richard Nixon to be impeached, not to know what that date was about. And it was a day for everybody to say, okay, I need to be observant. I need to see what's happening to my world and in my world, and I got to get out of the bubble. And so there were people that chose to do that and to look. But 99.9% of the world just goes on, you know, and it's back to show trials and hot dogs.
Well, and they always will. Marshall, we're going to come back in a moment, talk more about Planet X. We'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.